Thank you, sir.
Really pleased to welcome you to tonight's segment of the year-long colloquium, Civil Liberties in the 21st Century. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce Michael Parenti, but I understand exactly why I was asked to do this introduction. They want to keep it short, and they know if they ask me on a World Series night, it's going to be a short introduction. This colloquium was initiated by the Faculty Senate and is really a production of the Faculty Senate and the Office of the Provost, for which I and the University are very grateful. It's supported by the ROGO Distinguished Visiting Lectures Program, and most importantly, organized as the whole series of programs this year are organized by a talented and dedicated planning committee that consists of Gilda Aliotta, Mary Doust, Marsha Mohn, Katie Roy, Paul Siegel, and Phillies fan Don Weinholz. As I think you all know, we're spending a series of six different lectures and presentations like this evening's exploring civil liberties from a variety of perspectives and from a number of angles. So far this semester, we've had two different evenings, one on capital punishment and one on the right of self-defense. Tonight, economic democracy. And our speaker, Michael Parenti, who I... a political scientist and a provocative thinker. His interests are wide-ranging, politics, culture, economics, and history, and he's tackled, among other subjects, and current wars and other social ills. What you get from this list is he's a man of big ideas and someone notions, the Michael Parenti reader. His next book, the one he's currently working on, is entitled God and His Demons. And you can find out more about these books and the 18 others by looking at michaelparenti.org on the web. Before I introduce him formally, I want to tell you, I think those of you who know him will be very happy to hear this, that after his talk, Michael's agreed to take questions and answers. Since we are recording this on a video disc, we would ask you, if you wish to ask questions, to come over to the microphone in the aisle just next to Don Noel over there and ask your questions from that spot so we can record the questions as well as the answers. And with that, and with the World Series coming up after this evening, it's my pleasure to introduce Michael Parenti.
Are you going to stay for a little while for the talk? Okay. All right. Because you're right next to the door, I know. Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Let me start by talking about a subject that's not usually touched on, and that's capitalism And the dominant ideology today is that capitalism has given us democracy and prosperity. And what I want to argue is that, in fact, democracy, both economic and political, has emerged not along with the growth and accumulation of great wealth and capital, but in reaction to it. The Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is itself a document born of that struggle. These people who were called the Founding Fathers were men, were for the most part rich merchants, bankers, landowners, and slaveholders. A portion of them were slaveholders. Some of them were quite outspokenly against slavery, and there was some interesting back and forths that went on in the convention between them. So I'm not trying to map them all as with one brush. But for the most part, they were concerned about putting a government together that could set up the required infrastructure that was needed for the coming 19th century, which included a uniform currency, the breaking down of trade barriers between states, speaking with one voice in terms of relating to European powers. These are all very legitimate goals. But if you read closely, you find there was another concern that was on their mind. And that was the restive nature of the population. That contrary to the view that America was this prosperous, middle-class society made up of small farmers, everybody doing well, the United States of America in 1787 was a tumultuous place. I mean, there were debtor prisons, there were food riots, there were open rebellions. Just some months before, there had been Shays' rebellion in Rhode Island, an armed rebellion against the government. So they were actually worried about the population. And their remarks were recorded by one of the people attending. Actually, he took a near verbatim transcript of these people sitting together. And to me, that's a remarkable thing in history, that we've never had a situation where ruling elites planning a constitutional rule, consciously meeting in one place, talking about the specific things they have to do, and somebody unbeknownst to them was sitting there writing the whole thing out and everything they had to say. And that was James Madison who was writing this out. And he became known as the father of our Constitution because he preserved this incredible record. But note, he didn't publish that record till 50 years later, until everybody was dead, including himself. I mean, he was the last one left. He said, after I go, you can publish this now. And it went to the Library of Congress and they printed it out. But if you look at the comments that were being made, they were rather remarkable comments. Again and again, these men would get up and say, we don't want democracy. Democracy is an excess. The people are tumultuous. They're troublesome. George Washington began, and he said his first words, nearly his first words, were, gentlemen, let's not concern ourselves with trying to please the people. We're not here to please the people. We're here to make a government that works. And works what? For our interests. The rich and the well-born know best. The people are irresponsible. Madison then publicly in the Federalist Papers, Federalist number 10, that famous quote of his, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he meant political divisions, parties and such, the most common and durable source of faction is the various and unequal distribution of property. And by property, he meant wealth. You see, now, if people who talk like that today are called Marxists. But they all talk that way. Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, you can go back to John Harrington, right up through these times, Madison, Adams, Washington. They all talked like Marxists. The difference was when Marx said it, he said it disapprovingly, that there shouldn't be such a division. When they said it, this is the way we want it, and that's the way it is, that's what life is all about, and let's make it safe for the people who are on top of this tumultuous, for the individuals on top of this tumultuous thing called the people, the force, the democracy. And if you read ancient Rome, the book I wrote, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, I was struck by how the late Roman Republic did resemble the thing they were putting together in the Constitution. That is, a system that was made up of a whole series of checks and counter-checks and vetoes so that the status quo could never be too heavily challenged or overthrown or anything like that. The framers created a constitution that had an elaborate system of checks and vetoes and filters, too. There was a very limited franchise. About 10 or 15% of the population could vote in America in 1787. 50% of the people couldn't vote because they were women. About another 20% couldn't vote, both genders, because they were slaves or freedmen. Even the freedmen, of which there were hundreds of thousands, by the way, a couple of hundred thousand in the north and a couple of hundred thousand in the south, people who had been freed from slavery by their masters or who bought their freedom, who got out of it somehow. They, in most cases, they still couldn't vote. I don't think there was any case. I was just wondering if there was some water here. Excuse me. We ate at a restaurant that specialized in salt. Okay. And then among white males, there were property qualifications in just about every state in the Union except Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania pretty much had universal white male suffrage by this time. But in some states like South Carolina, I mean, you needed to be valued a certain amount to hope to be able to cast a ballot. So it was a very limited democracy. They set up a central government that could assume debt and tax the people to pay that debt. In effect, an upward redistribution of income from ordinary people to rich creditors and bankers. And they produced a constitution that had no Bill of Rights. There were no personal liberties, civil liberties in the constitution. A few, no ex post facto law, no Bill of Attainder. You know, some of the old monarchist abuses, they made sure that we didn't want that in the Constitution. But there was no Bill of Rights. Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, we need a Bill of Rights for the people. And it was almost unanimously voted down. A few delegates from Massachusetts said, good idea, but everybody else voted it down. So we don't want to bother with that stuff. And most interestingly, it was, as I said before, indirect representation. Almost every office was filtered. No office was directly elected, practically no office. The president was not elected by the people. He was elected by an electoral college. In fact, he still is elected by an electoral college today, with all the mishaps and problems that involves. The Supreme Court was unelected. It was appointed, and yet it served for life, which it still does. The Senate was elected by state legislatures. And that went on for about 130 years till about 1913 when that was changed by a constitutional amendment. Now the Senate is directly elected. Only the House of Representatives, and even there, most of these delegates said, we don't want to give this to the people. They will start stirring up trouble and this and that. And two people got up at that point, and that was Colonel Mason of Virginia and Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, and said, you know, you got to leave something for the people. This thing isn't going to fly if we make it too transparently protective and elitist and whatever else. And Franklin said, you know, the people fought very loyally and very well in a revolution against the monarchy, a monarchy that we all hated and all that. We owe them something. And so they grudgingly agreed to have a direct election of the House of Representatives. So that was probably the one democratic. And that's the old constitutional, ideology of that day, a mixed constitution. And again, back to the late republic of the, which had a Roman aristocratic senate and then had these tribunals. You had to be a commoner. If you were a patrician, you couldn't qualify, and the tribune could actually veto what the Senate was doing, but they had to be unanimous. I don't want to go into this. There's a whole many rigmaroles back and forth and this and that. But you could see this mixture of aristocracy, a monarchy, a presidency, an aristocracy with it, a Senate and a Supreme Court, and then an assembly, as in Rome, and that would be the House. In an odd way, it was very much, and these men were seeped in Cicero. They all read the Romans and the Greeks and such. Well, then they had to get this constitution, ratified. Thanks. Glad you came tonight. Had to get the constitution ratified. And that was a different problem. To get that done, all sorts of people in the states were saying, whoa, wait a minute. And they realized the tactical error. We're not ratifying, we're ratifying this constitution conditionally. And that's what any number of states did. We ratify this constitution conditionally. Only if what? You produce a Bill of Rights. Yeah. You gotta have a Bill of Rights. So sure enough, Madison sat down and they wrote a pretty good Bill of Rights. Let me show you one thing in the Bill of Rights that nobody ever talks about. It's called the Ninth Amendment. You know, the Bill of Rights is the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment reads as follows. I just thought of it the other night. I was listening to the radio and there was talk about single payer and the right of all Americans to have health care and all that. And somebody called up and said, and it was kind of pathetic because the guy who called up, by his accent and all, he sounded like he lived in a trailer and he was a country music fan. All that. We don't want stereotypes here, but I'm giving you one, I know. But he says, where in the Bill of Rights, I'd like to know where in the Bill of Rights where in the Constitution do we have the constitutional right to have health care? I don't think we have the constitutional right to have health care. As they say, America is the only country where people demonstrate against health care. The Europeans can't really figure us out, you know, and that sort of thing. So, the announcer said, well, we got a lot of things in modern society that aren't in the Constitution, which is enough answer. But there is the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment, totally ignored, it's been, I think. And I'm waging this one-person campaign. Would you like to join me now to revive the Ninth Amendment? It reads as follows. It's only about 20 words. It reads, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So the answer is, yes, that right isn't in the Constitution. We were just retaining it ourselves under the Ninth Amendment. And Hamilton was right about that. He said, you enumerate certain rights that you're going to implicitly be saying all the other rights we have are no longer rights because you haven't enumerated them. It was an opportunistic argument. He just didn't want a Bill of Rights, period. But there's something to that. So we have to understand that, in fact, the Bill of Rights is the first step in our protection. It's not the final word in the protection of our civil liberties and such. So the men who feared and loathed democracy, I mean, the things they said about it, they sounded like Cicero and his gang, yet they found it necessary to show some regard for popular sentiment, as with the direct election in the House. So they ruled, but they didn't rule quite in the way they wanted to. They were powerful, but they were not omnipotent, you see. They reluctantly made democratic concessions under threat of land seizures by the poor and debtor rebellions and all that sort of such. The rich founders, they were driven not by a love of democracy, but by a fear of it. Not by a love of the people, but by a prudent desire to avoid riot and insurgency. The Constitution then was a product not only of class privilege, but of class struggle. A struggle, by the way, that continues right to this day. Democracy, ladies and gentlemen, democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to defend themselves against the greed and the abuse of wealth. That's what civil liberties was in 1787, and that's what it was from the very beginning in ancient Rome and in ancient Greece. You go back to the 6th century in ancient Greece, and you find the Hoplites. The Hoplites got up. The Hoplites were the small farmers in Greece. They were, one thing you say about an army, armies through all of history have been class and caste systems. The officer class were the class of wealth, and the foot soldiers and such were the commoners. And the Hoplites were small farmers, just prosperous enough to be able to afford a sword and a shield and basic armament. They were the Greek infantry, not much of an infantry in Athens, but they were something. And suddenly they got together under Cleisthenes when he was the leader, an aristocrat with a very big aristocratic family, but with very strong democratic leanings. And they said, that's enough. We're not fighting anymore. Until you give us the vote in the assembly and we have a voice in what's war and what isn't war and what's happening, what isn't happening, until we get that voice, we're not going in. So they got the voice. Well, there it was, you see. It was a remarkable social arrangement. So what you had in Greece were literally artisans, small farmers, workers, people in Athens who sat in the assembly. You only sat for 2 days. There was a rotation. It was popular. It wasn't a representative system. It was actual people from the population. These were people who, in a lot of the other Greek cities, were slaves. I mean, Plato and Socrates loved and adored Sparta. That's what they wanted. They hated the Athenian democracy. They said, why should a shoemaker have a say about the state? A shoemaker should have the last word about making shoes, not about the state. He doesn't know anything about the state and so forth and so on. And they loved Sparta. In Sparta, those people were slaves. They were helots, they were called. So there's that breakthrough. And the same thing happened with the Roman Republic. They overthrew the Etruscan kings and they never wanted another king. But they, for years anyway, they fought, and the issues they fought over, the issues that concerned them were land holdings, the possibility of land reform, that they, farmers could get back their lands from the big latifundio owners. Latifundios is what they were called. It's a Latin word which comes down to us through the Spanish, through Latin America, but it's a Latin word. Run by slaves, you know, they fought against that. They fought for debt relief. They fought for rent control in Rome itself. Amazing issues, and they fought to get relief from taxes. So what I'm saying here is that the engine that leads to an expansion of political rights often is economic justice. The fight for economic justice is what is what leads to this democratic rights. The same thing happened with the expansion of the franchise in the U.S. Am I giving you too much history? Is this dull? This history? Is it? No? Okay. Good. The same thing happened with the U.S. workers in America in the 1820s and 1830s. They didn't have the vote. U.S. workers were not concerned about the vote as such. I mean, workers didn't just get up and say, I want to be able to vote. It's just some inner expression, I feel. What they wanted was enough food to feed themselves and their family. And that meant decent wages. To get decent wages, they discovered they had to organize and do collective bargaining to fight united together against the boss. But they couldn't do that because it was against the law. This organizing together were called what we call labor unions today. They called combinations. And combinations were against the law in most states. This was a violation of due process. This was you're trying to expropriate the boss's property through collusion in this way and such. So now they had to change the laws. But to change the laws, what did they need? They needed the vote. In any case, for other kinds of protections, they needed the vote also. And so there were these fights that went on all during the 1820s and 1830s, which enabled the white male workers to get the vote. So here again, in the pursuit of economic democracy, they expanded political democracy and they expanded their own civil liberties. And the expansion of political democracy becomes a tool, as imperfect and inadequate a tool it is, but it becomes a tool for protecting economic interests or winning new economic gains. You can say the same things about the women's struggle that went on for 100 years. Women needed the vote. There's a marvelous movie on that, by the way. You should see it if you ever get a chance. I think it's called Iron-Jawed Angels. Iron-Jawed Angels. It with Hilary Swank. It's a marvelous movie about the suffragist movement in the 19th century when she's asked at one point, why do you women want the vote? And there's just a close-up shot of her, no background, you don't know who she's talking to and all. And she just begins to say her humanity, what she needs, the protections, this, that. It's a great movie, but women had very real, as they still do, very real, substantive economic issues, like getting a working wage, like equal pay, protection, property rights. They almost all were divested of property rights. A woman married a husband, he became the owner of her property, her inheritance, if she had an inheritance. Education. Women in many states could not go to law school or medical school or graduate school and such. So it was more than just a matter of equality for equality's sake as some vacuum, but for very real substantial economic rights, which are also part of the quality and meaning of life. The same goes for the civil rights movement. I won't even go into the abolitionist movement. That's so obvious. But the civil rights movement, which is often seen as a question of being able to sit anywhere you want on the bus, which is not purely just a psychological or social issue. That impacts on your material life too. If you can't even sit in a place in the bus that you might want to, like anybody else. But it was also, even if you read the old civil rights leaders who are often looked down during the militant years of the 60s as being so conservative and such, people like White and Whitney Young and such, you read this stuff, they talked about jobs, they talked about housing, education, they talked about very real things that black people, African Americans needed, protection from police abuse. These are all still, while gains have been made indeed, these are all still very real issues, both for African Americans and for women. Especially with women, the issue of personal safety is an issue that is really in need of more attention. All right. Well, I can give other examples and such, but let's go on. Let me say something about democracy here. Democracy, we see now, democracy has two components to it. There's the one we all know, which is procedural democracy, or what we call political democracy, and that's voting, the right to assembly, the right to petition the office holders, the right to run for office yourself, so forth. And elections and such. Then there's what I call substantive democracy, or others have called economic democracy. That is, the democracy also has an economic and social content. It must be measured by its outcomes and not just its ability to hold elections. I mean, this country nobody can deny we have an ability to hold elections. How reliable and honest they are, that's being called into question again after some years. But we have elections for president down to dog catcher and city commissioner, water commissioner, school board, whatever. But the question is, what's the output? What does this do for us in terms of the actual payoff, the substantive democracy? Is there some measure of economic justice that helps in the development of our lives and in the preservation of political democracy? There is a view that's enjoyed much currency some years ago, which said that the public does not rule. It picks those who do. The public then just gives its stamp of approval or disapproval at the next election. The public chooses between competing elites, and it's the elites that determine the issues and make the policies. It's sort of like a referendum democracy, you know. Now, that model of elite democracy was enunciated by Joseph Schumpeter, a very eminent political economist, some of whose work I like. I don't agree with him on this issue. Walter Lippmann had this view. More recently, mainstream political scientists like Diane Ziegler, they talked about elite democracies, that it's the elites that really are the dynamo, and the people are a passive mass, and what we do is we're presented with the thing, and then we say, okay or no, or, well, I like that elite as opposed to that one. And certainly that does explain what seems to be political life in America at times. But that it describes something doesn't mean we should elevate it to being the preferred ideology of the society, which is what some of these writers do. There was one of the greatest political thinkers we produced in recent years was you all know him, maybe you know him, most of you seem old enough to know him, Spiro Agnew. Remember Spiro Agnew? Okay, good, you got to learn. He was vice president under Richard Nixon. He had to leave the vice presidency because of corruption and money grabbing charges and all that sort of thing. But when he was at the height of his glory, he used to say, the citizen is to the leader the way a patient is to a doctor. You can come with a complaint and all, but then you have to leave it up to the leader because he knows how to solve it, you see. Well, what we would call daddy knows best sort of thing. And he was vice president. He was one of the leaders. He just won re-election, so he has faith. You know how to pick the right doctors, and now you keep quiet, and we'll take care now, and we take care of you. There's something about that model that makes me uncomfortable. I don't know quite what it is. I would argue that history shows that popular forces do not muster themselves only at elections. They agitate other times. They resist. They organize. They strike. They demand. They demonstrate. They refuse to serve. In other words, it's not true that all or most democratic policy originates with the policymakers, with the policy elites. I'm going to argue even further than that. I would say that almost all policy that is worthwhile and life-affirming comes from the non-elites. It comes from you people and others like you. And I think that an ounce of data is worth a pound of polemics. So let me just give you some data. Whose idea was it to have the hoplites in the Greek assembly actually participating? You know whose idea it was? It wasn't Socrates. It wasn't Plato. It wasn't Cleisthenes even. It wasn't even his young lieutenant who became the greatest leader of Greek democracy in history, Pericles. They weren't. It was the hoplites themselves. They had the idea. They came up with the idea. You wait for the elites to take care of your rights, and you're going to wait a few centuries and lifetimes. Well, and we saw, I don't want to repeat what I've just said in this lecture, we've seen the expansion of voting rights for women, for African Americans, for workers in the 1820s. That came from the people themselves. The struggle for women's rights, the struggle for civil rights. Who? You named me the president, the policy elite, the corporate elite, the financial leader, the great intellectual, the great artist, the great performer. You named the Nobel Prize winner. Name them who came out and generated this. It was the women themselves. It was African Americans themselves. It was workers themselves. And those three categories are not mutually exclusive. You know, you got women who are African Americans who are workers and so forth. Franklin Roosevelt was in the White House 12 years. He never came out against Jim Crow. He never came out for a Fair Employment Practice Commission, FEPC, we used to call it then. 12 years. Harry Truman did, only reluctantly, because he was pushed from below, that's all. John Kennedy was downright opposed to Martin Luther King's mobilization march, and he wished he could prevent it. He didn't want to get into the civil rights struggles and all. He used to talk about, we should solve our thing, not with people marching out in the street. He was scandalized by these demonstrations at first. It was relatively rare in the early 60s. By the end of the 60s, of course, they were grateful that people were just marching in the streets. And name for me the political economic elites of the 19th century who struggled for a 10-hour day through the 19th century, and then later on who struggled for an 8-hour day in the early part of the 20th century. Name them. You know, there's no names. I'll tell you who struggled for that. It was the people who were working 10-hour days or 12-hour days and 14-hour days. Name the big leader who opposed child labor laws. It was people from laboring families who said, I want to send my kid to school, not into a factory for 14 hours a day. And the children themselves, by the way, at times. The struggle for public education and public libraries. The struggle to end child labor. I just mentioned it. The struggle for clean and safe drinking water. Still unaccomplished. The struggle for safe housing codes. For public parks. There may have been individuals of favored backgrounds who latched onto these once the thing got going and got visibility. There are any number of prominent personalities who came in. But they weren't generals without troops. There were troops there, you know, and they then come in. That's why when we have big marches and, you know, and all those big celebrity names are going to come and speak, people will, you know, when we have anti-war marches and people say, oh, you know, Susan Sarandon's going to come speak, Sean Penn, and all Hollywood, all various Hollywood names are all going to come speak there. That's going to make it. That's going to attract an enormous. No, it's the other way around. It's not an enormous number of people come to hear the stars speak. The stars come because there's going to be an enormous number of people there. It's big enough now for them to get up at the spotlight and speak. And that's the way it was with these people too. A constant struggle for every one of these things. If these were things that the rich and powerful wanted, those of privilege and possession, position, then there wouldn't have been any struggle. It would have been done. Today, too, the environmental movement. Name the political or corporate leader who generated it. A few elites, again, maybe got on the bandwagon, but it came from the public. It came from the concerns of laypersons, much of whose effort was devoted to, is still today devoted to getting the Environmental Protection Agency to do the things that it was paid to do and collecting a salary to do. The consumer protection movement, getting unsafe products and medications off the market. That's not a capitalist government that gets things off the market. It's too busy putting things on the market with subsidies and export supports, even for a lethal thing like tobacco. Investment tax breaks, loan guarantees, research and development subsidies for corporate producers. That's what the government is doing. It depends on ordinary people to fight for the ban on tobacco and liquor advertising, the anti-nuclear movement, the exposure of the victimization of GIs and workers and downwinders, as they were called, people who lived downwind from the tests in Utah who got very sick and all that. The exposure of Rocky Flats, Hanford Nuclear Reservation. That's not government or industry. They were too busy covering all that up. That's been people who have fought for that. And I can go on. Freedom of Information Act, the same thing. Now, I don't want to overstate it. I don't want to be too one-sided. We have to be balanced, right? We've got to be balanced here. So I do want to say that policy elites have played a creative role in a number of things, and there are policies that they have generated all on their own, and I'll give you a few of those. The Manhattan Project to build an atomic bomb to wipe out Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That was purely a policy. There was no popular demand in America for that bomb. There were no demonstrations. The nuclear industry, which was developed and then handed over to private business at a fraction of the cost and still subsidized heavily, creating the FBI, the CIA, the National Security State apparatus, the global military apparatus with about 700 military bases all around the world, with new ones being built in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, in Kosovo, McCarthyism, the ideological witch hunts, loyalty and security programs. These were all put from the top down. People didn't demonstrate and say we want loyalty security programs. Foreign aid programs to military dictatorships, getting into wars, creating crises. How many of you have ever seen, or probably wouldn't be on, but have you ever seen a demonstration said, let's go to war with Afghanistan? Were there big demonstrations? Was it on a weekend I was out of town? Or exactly. Secret surveillance of our personal lives and the like. So you got to give them credit. See, I'm being balanced here. I'm being balanced. Well, economic democracy has been in retreat over the last 30 years or so. The taxes on the super rich have declined. The taxes on the middle class and working class have increased. Labor unions being wiped out. Larger and larger subsidies to corporate America. Corporate taxes have been wiped out. Corporations used to pay about 25-30% of the tax bill. Now they pay like 5% or something. Massive wages have been kept flat and even rolled back, and benefits have cut despite the tremendous increase in productivity. And we wonder why we're in a recession and a crisis here, where you keep increasing production, squeezing your labor force, getting 4 workers to do the work that 5 did last year. That's an actual figure. From 2006 to 2007, by 2007, you had 4 workers in America were producing what in 2006, 5 workers were producing. So that's an increase, a 20% increase in productivity in 1 year. There was no 20% increase in people's wages, or even a 10% or 5%. Wages were kept flat. And so that was the profit. The trouble is, you know, if you keep production going and you have nobody to buy it, you then enter into what is the real cause of the recession. Now, when the people try to mobilize against the rollback, against forces that are destroying the social democracy, the economic democracy, they use their civil liberties as a way of trying to organize, protect themselves, protest. Then the struggle is shifted, is directed not only on the marketplace, but against the political liberties that enabled the populace to resist economic rollback and make advances. So what you've had is repression, and that repression is getting really serious. The two biggest examples I can give most recently is in Minneapolis at the Republican National Convention, where these police came in, the Darth Vaders. You see them, right, with the helmets, and all in black and padded up and shields and everything else, coming in and really lacing and beating up peaceful demonstrators, using a few little group of anarchist kids who broke a few windows, using that excuse to come in then, and going into their houses beforehand where they were planning their demonstrations and such, and breaking their computers and arresting the people in there on trumped up charges and such. That was in Minneapolis in 2008. And then just recently in Pittsburgh at the G20 meeting, the same thing. These guys charging, and the display of police strength is just rather amazing, you know. I mean, you see hundreds and hundreds of these guys equipped like this, each one of them, and going in there and really going at it and rounding up these people. The last time I was arrested it was in San Francisco. It was a demonstration, totally peaceful demonstration, and we were just trapped. We were trapped in certain streets, and suddenly that street was blocked off. We said, well, let's go back. We started to go back, and there were police here. They just rounded up, I think about 400 or 500 of us, And where does that police strength come from? I mean, where does that energy, how do they get that going there? I was just reading a story in yesterday's paper, you may have read it, about Cleveland, in Cleveland, about this guy who was murdering these women, raping, beating them up, torturing them, strangling them. He had a history of doing that. He spent 15 years in prison for strangling a woman. And the police, reports were given to the police and they didn't follow up. They didn't act on it. They didn't. But you give those same police, you tell them that the people are mobilizing and going to try and take over the bank downtown. They'll be out there defending that bank with their shields and their and everything ready. I mean, they'll be ordered to do that, of course. As suppressing the vote, dominating the airwaves, and all sorts of things like that. No-fly lists, harassing people in that way. Every time I come back from Europe, I get yanked out of line. I don't know why. I'm coming home and the guy says, "You come here." They talk like that. "You come here." You know, big. And if you want to say, try to be polite or something, you'll be there a weekend. You know. So you just I say, "Yeah." He said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a writer." He said, "Give me the title of the last book you wrote." Now, how do you know about a book? I mean, most writers don't write books. They write all sorts of other kinds of copies and stuff. So it wasn't the last book, but it was the best title I wanted to give him. I said, "The Assassination of Julius Caesar." I really dwell on this. His eyes got big like that. When I said, "The Assassination," his eyes got big like of Julius Caesar. He didn't know who Julius Caesar was. But he says, "So you write books." He says, "Go over there." And I go over there, and another guy questions me. He says, "How are you getting home from the airport?" I said, "I have a friend picking me up." He said, "What's your friend's name?" And, you know, I didn't want to tell him her name. It's none of his business. I was actually tempted to say, "Well, his name is Abdul Muhammad, and he, and he's just a student. He's here taking flying lessons, and he's." But then I knew I'd be there all night the next day, you know. So I said, "I don't think you have to know her name. I mean, it's my girlfriend or something." Yeah. Said, yeah, yeah. Another time I came back from Serbia, you know, after the war, and stupidly it said the place of last disembarkment or whatever the word. And I should have put Frankfurt because it was a connecting flight to Frankfurt, then it would have been fine. I put Belgrade, Serbia. So the guy looks at it, he says, "You just came from Siberia." I said, no, Serbia, it's in Europe. "Yeah, yeah, go over there." And they went, again, they went through my, this, and I had literature and articles and says, "What's this article?" I said, "It's my article. I'm a writer. That's what I do. I write articles, you see." I said, "Oh," and they didn't quite know what to do, but they wanted to throw me in jail, you know. I mean, that's the feeling. Well, we don't want them get them to the point where they can automatically throw us in jail. But this is the kind of thing, under the name of security, of keeping us safe and secure, this is the kind of stuff they're pulling on us. And what we have to do is resist and fight back. I think I've probably talked enough, haven't I? I mean, I've got some more stuff here on freedom of speech, but you guys know all that. Let me just say one last thing, that democracy, let me say this about democracy. Democracy is not something that should be preserved. We always hear that. It's got to be preserved. It's like it's a precious Grecian urn, you know, careful with our democracy, our dear, dear little democracy. Democracy is really something that has to be practiced, and you've got to exert it and expand on it. As with the physical body, so with the body politic. Our capacities are more likely to grow if they're exercised and developed. Use it or lose it. That's what you can say about democracy. Use it or lose it. When they got 100,000 people out on the street, they really can't tell you you cannot address that subject. If you're one lone person, maybe, then they will try or something of the sort. And rather than fear an excess of democracy, as a lot of our media pundits and academic mandarins do, we should really struggle for more victories, better human services, more victories for labor unions, more protests against racism, sexism, homophobia, militarism, and against capitalism's, corporate capitalism's apparent willingness to destroy the environment, more against U.S. interventions around the world in countries that we really have no business being in. We must push for more not-for-profit sustainable economic development, more democratic ownership of productive forces and services, more ideological variety and dissidence in the media, more listener-controlled access to radio and television stations. Essential to such an agenda is a freedom of speech that is not limited to media moguls and their acolytes, but it's available to people of all ideological persuasions. Our struggle is to reach larger publics with a dissident message to counter the endless flood of corporate and official propaganda that really inundates us today. So our civil liberties are not a seminar. They are an integral part of the struggle for peace and social justice and economic justice. They are the necessary condition for real democracy. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's okay, B plus? Questions, is that... Anybody want to ask any questions? I've really pretty much answered everything already. Yeah, you got to come up to the microphone because they want it all on tape, and they don't want to. Oh yeah, why do they want it all on tape?
If I hear a knock on my door.
Yes.
I just want to. You
talk. We have about ways of making you talk, young man. Go ahead. Yeah.
You talk about democracy and direct democracy. That any increase in what people can do directly for themselves without sort of the elite body politic is good. But I'd ask what you think about in the last year and a half what we've seen with gay marriage, where like the courts, the unelected courts in California, gave the rights of homosexual couples to marry, and then a referendum by the people took that right away. And then in Massachusetts, just a couple of days ago, the legislature and the governor had signed a law into effect, and then there was another...
No, that's Maine you're talking about.
Maine. And I'd just be curious to see what you think about that, how people organized for that, and then the people took it away. Right?
No, that's a very good example, right, that's one of the risks you have, that if people out of custom and hidebound tradition, or out of just false consciousness, or out of some commitment to values that are undemocratic, what happens? Because what you had happen is, a democratically elected legislature and governor passed this law allowing gay marriage, and then you had a more, quote, democratic action, which is direct referendum to the people, because they know that there are all sorts of people will come out of the woodwork and... yeah, that's a risk. I mean, but that's what the anti-democratic theorists, that's red meat for them. They love that. And they can say, why do you trust the common people when in fact they're so common? That becomes my book, Contrary Notions, which is a collection of my writings, anthology of such. I have an article in there called Are Heterosexuals Worthy of Marriage? And it talks about what heterosexuals have done to marriage. And, you know, they talk about how they have, marriage has always been between one man and one woman. It was never been between one man. It's always between one man and as many wives as he could afford, for the first 6 or 7,000 years, and still is in many parts of the world today. And Yeah, and the hypocrisies around marriage and the way marriage has been used to mistreat women and such, and there's a whole bunch of things in the article, but it's really pathetic to deny people a basic human right because you've decided this, because the Bible said it. You know, there's a whole bunch of things the Bible has said that nobody pays attention to now, like thou shalt not practice usury, right? Tell that to the credit card companies and yet these Christian right wingers, they're not excited about usury. They don't get upset about that. But homosexuality, there's about 3 or 4 references to it in the Bible, maybe a few more, and condemnations. Well, the Bible condemns all sorts of other things. You know, it condemns you if you wear garments of mixed thread. Did you know that? You got a hand in your whole wardrobe now, if you really want. That's a good question. I don't know what you would say, except to say that this is my side. I say the commoners are usually right, but it doesn't mean that they're infallible. And there is such a thing as false consciousness, and people do have these customs. You know, we can go to countries where you have men who think it's an obligation, not a crime, but an obligation to kill their own daughter because she's been raped. She's been raped by some townies. Now my family is shamed. Nobody comes and visits us anymore. The only way we restore I wrote about this in my book, The Culture Struggle, small little book, if you're interested in question of cultural relativism and human rights and such. The only way to restore the honor of our family is I have to kill my own daughter. I mean, what kind of maniac is this? That's the custom. And then they get up and say, you show respect for our culture. This is our custom, and don't you? I don't show respect for your culture when you're killing people. I'm sorry. There are human rights that transcend culture. Culture permeates all our lives and all that, but it's not the sum total of our human existence. And we have a homophobic culture here. We've come quite a way so far, but we have a lot of work to do, and to tell people that. Look, there are countries where gay marriage is legal. What's happened? The societies haven't unraveled. Canada hasn't unraveled. Some of the Western European countries, they've had legal gay marriage. Marriage itself hasn't. Heterosexuals are still getting married, you know.
I was just wondering what you think about the idea that democratically elected legislatures and governors with their unelected appointees can sometimes moderate a populace, you know, by passing progressive legislation or any kind of legislation that is in accordance with a right to sort of act as a buffer against. Like, I would imagine that when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, if you polled the country, 51% wouldn't of white America probably wouldn't have been for the Civil Rights Bill.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Yeah, that's a case where if you mobilize your activists and you direct them at people who are in positions of responsibility, who then accept that idea and who are educated, and they respond to that, that has a higher visibility, and then that passive mass would come along. And it's also a model of the founding fathers, where they said that filter would work for a better effect. That might be one example where that happened. But good example, yeah. Good example about a bad thing.
Why do you think the left isn't speaking out against 9/11 when there were controlled demolitions for the Twin Towers and Building Number 7, which was never hit by any plane or anything like that? And then when you talk about the Pentagon, where there was a small little opening where it couldn't have possibly been a jet, where it had to be something
well,
small.
I don't know about that. That opening was the size of a jet. It was about 16. They said 9/11 people said 16 feet in diameter, that couldn't be a plane. Sure, 16 feet is plenty of room for a plane. And you do see the wing injured marks on the sides. The wings recede like this, and it hit there. But I don't know. I don't know where the film. There's
no,
so many questions. There are so many questions, unanswered questions, by the way, on both sides. There's all sorts of questions I would have on both sides. But the critics, the people who say that 9/11 was an inside job, they're under no obligation to answer all their questions. The government is, and we really do need a more systematic investigation of what happened
and
how it happened.
It's mainly like David Ray Griffin that's speaking about it, and it seems like just, you know, some of the more popular people on the left just aren't speaking out about it. And that was like one of the main reasons that the U.S. government gives for going into
I told you I think the reason is that people are not really that persuaded. What could I honestly say to you? That the case has so many unanswered questions on both sides, and I don't know if we'll ever get to the truth. It doesn't mean that they accept the government's. There are two conspiracy theories here. The one put out by the government, that there was a conspiracy of about 16 young Islamic students, mostly Saudi Arabians, one or two Egyptians. Now, there's no Afghanis, as far as I know, but we then bombed Afghanistan. And they hijacked these two planes. That's a conspiracy theory. And there's another conspiracy theory, which was that this was an inside job in which those planes were remotely directed into these buildings, and that was done to create a casus belli, a Pearl Harbor kind of mentality that would allow us to invade Iraq. That part of looking for a casus belli is not conspiracy. That's a fact. That's right there in the Project for a New American Century in their article, which they've since removed from the website, which says that we need another Pearl Harbor to get people behind the idea of invading Iraq. This is a year before 9/11. So they definitely were conspiring to look for a reason to invade Iraq. Now, if the things happened the way you say, or Griffin, I don't know, I've been to several conferences. I even wrote an endorsement blurb for Barry Zwicker's book. I said, as a skeptic, I find a lot here that is really, but it doesn't really come together for me.
Okay, but just one key fact.
No, I'm not going to get into a 9/11 discussion about the particulars. It's just not something I can do. And now you stalk out or whatever, that which is the way the 9/11 people usually exit. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the your work in progress. God and His Demons.
Oh no, that book was finished. I finished it over a year ago. It's coming out in March. It'll be coming out in a couple of months by Prometheus.
In that case, it's too late for me to suggest a change in the title to God and Her Demons. But
well, I raise that question. I say, why is God a He? Why not a Her or an It?
What can you tell us about the book? I'm really intrigued by it. I'm looking forward to it.
The book is a critical study of the abuses of organized religion, a history and such. Without taking an atheist view, I mean, I don't know what the hell. I don't know what I am. I mean, what is all that up there? I mean, what is that? It always awes me and everything. I sort of take Einstein's position where he said, you know, when all is said and done, and there's these enormous dynamics and energies and all this thing that's happening, which we really can't even fathom or explain, that's God to me. That's what God is.
Well, you're like the rest of us. You're confused.
Right. Yeah, but
well, thank you.
But I'd rather be confused than be certain in this area. It's the people who are certain. They're the dangerous ones, and they are killing. When you write a book about religion, you're going to write a book about organized religion, you find yourself writing about intolerance, hatred, violence, oppression, political power, predatory sex, and money, 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 money. That's the George Carlin. I got to do the George Collins. Remember, if ever go to your YouTube and go look at that, the best 12 minutes you'll ever see on YouTube. It's George Carlin, and the title is "Religion is Bull." Beep, and "Religion is Bullshit." That's what he calls it. And he begins. He says, "There are people who believe that there's a guy in the sky who sees everything you're doing and knows what you're doing. He's all-knowing, all-powerful, but he needs money. he says, he's cosmic. He created the whole cosmos, but he just can't handle money. And he just needs money from you. And he goes on like that. But I won't do it. I'm tempted to try to do his whole routine, but I won't do that. But anyway, that's what my book is about. It's about the dangers of those things today and through history. And it was great. I had a great time writing, reading the Bible. That's a book I really, if you want to blow your mind, go read that book sometime. No, don't bother. Okay. That's it. Is there any more questions? One last question.
Yeah. Professor Parente, I wanted to ask you a question way of an anecdote. A couple weeks ago, NPR did a program about Iraq, and they had on the chief librarian for the new Iraqi library that's been rebuilt. And the reporter who was asking the questions would ask about why the Iraqis are not stepping up to the plate in terms of democracy. He'd ask several ancillary questions. I mean, for 20 minutes, till a point where my nose almost started bleeding from frustration. So I tried to call in. The screener got me. He hemmed and hawed, but he wouldn't put me on. Luckily, this other woman from Texas called in and let this guy have it with both barrels about how dare you ask this man these questions when we illegally attacked their country. We killed over 1 million people, et cetera, et cetera. The guy didn't know what to do. He started stuttering. So the question I would like to ask is, you taught us about there's a certain type of propaganda where you don't just lie. You could lie by omission, and you can lie by using background assumptions. Could you detail that in the way of what this reporter was doing in terms of Iraq?
That's another whole lecture, you know, but I'll just give you one point, which is this idea of teaching the Iraqis democracy. Well, the Iraqis had a revolution in 1968, and they had a democracy. They set up a government. It was a multi-party government made up of constitutionalists, progressives, Democrats, some petty bourgeois elements, and some communists. All in this government, they nationalized the oil industry. They took it away from the British and American oil companies. That was the unforgivable sin. And they had a democracy, and they were using the publicly owned oil earnings now, and they were using it to build schools and clinics and all that sort of thing. And it was at that time that the CIA came along with a guy they recruited. His name was Saddam Hussein. His first gig for the CIA was to assassinate the prime minister. He shot him. He didn't succeed in killing him, but he wounded him. They hustled him away to a safe house, I think, in Saudi Arabia or someplace, whatever else. He later became head of the Ba'athist Party, and he systematically tortured, drove underground or into exile every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every progressive, student leaders, labor leaders, all sorts of people. That was Saddam Hussein. And so, in fact, they destroyed the democracy that was their own creation. And as I say, democracy comes from its own people. It's not something you bring over and you here now. I'm going to teach you poor little underdeveloped, backward people. Here's a civilization, 5,000-year-old civilization. You're going to teach them about this. There's a total amnesia about that. Total amnesia that Saddam Hussein was Washington's poster boy. When he was killing and torturing at his worst, he was Washington's poster boy. It's only when he got out of line on the oil quotas. It's only when he refused to privatize the economy. He kept it state-owned. And he even kept some of the social programs that the other government had. They didn't like him because of that. Donald Rumsfeld said that very explicitly. Strobe Talbott, who was Deputy Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, came out in an introduction to John Norris's book, and he said, oh, no, I'm sorry. That's Yugoslavia. I'll tell you that anyway. He said, the only reason we really bombed Yugoslavia is they refused to privatize their economy. It had nothing to do with imaginary atrocities and all that. And all sorts of progressives supported that war, you know, stood shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House. But the same thing with Iraq. They went after Saddam Hussein when he started getting out of line. He wanted a larger oil quota. He wanted to be able to sell more oil. It wasn't that, he's going to keep oil. We won't get our oil for our cars and our houses and all that. Quite the contrary. These guys want to sell the oil, but they want to sell it directly and make the profit. They don't want to have to sell it to Chevron and Exxon and all these people. So they're in a word, and none of that was ever talked about. None of that. All we got was, out of nowhere, Saddam Hussein was a wicked dictator, and we will have to invade his country and kill him and kill a million of his people and such. And they didn't say that, but that's what the result has been. Make this the last question? Yeah.
I was just wondering about the Supreme Court, whether you would feel that people should have ability to interpret the Constitution as opposed to having nine justices do it, or do you think it's fine the way it is set up at the present time?
It's not fine the way it is. I'd have a Supreme Court that could not do conservative judicial activism or any kind of where you literally take laws and gratuitously give them new interpretations to force them to be recycled. Most of it is not judicial review, it's judicial interpretation, and they're always interpreting. And also I'd have justices who were elected for 10 years, let's say, and not for life. Why should longevity be rewarded in that way? And they should handle a more limited range of cases. I mean, I guess you do need a court of final appeal and some things. So that's about the best I could say on that. Anyway, anybody have any other ideas on the Supreme Court? Oh, okay.
Thank you for joining us for a very productive evening.